ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
First tonight, a major security breach impacting possibly millions of customers of one of the country's biggest telecommunications companies. Optus is scrambling to respond to a cyber attack which has seen information stolen, including names, dates of birth and phone numbers. For some, it goes even further with passport and driver's license numbers compromised, although the company insists all payment and account details remain secure.
This attack was in September of 2022, and along with one on Medibank the following month, it put cyber attacks on the agenda, both for the Albanese government and for company boards around the country. Hello, I'm Richard Aidy. This is The Money. Cyber attacks are a big deal and getting bigger. The most recent estimate is that it's costing the country $42 billion a year. And of course, that's a fraction of the international bill. Nick Espinosa runs the US-based consultancy Security Fanatics.
There was a study that was done in 2017 that basically said by 2021, the world collectively will have spent $1 trillion defending themselves. That's $1 trillion US. And that is everything from the Australian government to the US government to the small coffee shop in Mumbai, India, and everybody in between. And in that period, the attackers would have taken over $6 trillion US from us. And we not only met that number, we've exceeded it. And that number continues to grow year over year. So this is a massive problem worldwide. And I don't care who you are or where you are, if you're connected to the internet, this is a problem that is following you.
The numbers are staggering. They include the cost of the hack itself, losing data, losing the ability to run a business, worst case, losing critical infrastructure like an electricity network. There's also the cost to an organization's reputation. Think of what happened to Optus. Jay Jong's a senior research fellow at the University of Melbourne.
A similar incident actually occurred in the UK with the Royal Mail Service. They had a significant data breach at the beginning of last year. Now, if you talk about the loss, economic loss, and the potential for business loss from a cyber or a data-related perspective, those costs are insignificant compared to the 6 weeks of disruptions that occurred where none of the parcels that were being sent could be processed through Royal Mail Service. So hence, all of that business went to other third-party competitors. And those are long-term losses, right? They're not just the spur-of-the-moment losses. That's a considerable business loss post-incident as well.
Which means that managing that sort of incident, or better still, preventing it, is quite the growth industry.
The cybersecurity community around the world, specifically if we're looking at cybersecurity consulting, has a compound annual growth rate of about 3.3%, and that's been consistent over the last 5 years. By the end of 2023, essentially the world collectively spent $17 billion roughly on cybersecurity consulting. And mind you, that's just the consulting. That's not the tools you buy. Those aren't the firewalls or the antivirus or anything else. And essentially, that compound annual growth rate at the end of 2023 was actually 3.8%. And essentially by 2030, we're looking at a $44 billion plus industry just on the consulting side as well, with an annual growth rate of almost 11%. So that is a huge number. And quite frankly, everybody's hacking everybody out there. And so we are not short on work by any stretch of the imagination.
Cybersecurity consultants are external. The people who do the job in-house are Chief Information Security Officers, or CISOs. David Cullen is at the company CISO Lens.
We've got, I think, as far as our members are concerned, an increasing threat environment at the moment. We know the statistics coming out of the Australian Cybersecurity Centre would show us that we've got a new cyber attack being reported to the Commonwealth Government every 6 minutes, which is growing year on year. And what our members are telling us is that those attacks, whilst we still see many trivial attacks on our networks, they are certainly becoming more sophisticated as well.
And CISOs are getting their message across.
One of the things that is consistent in terms of the feedback that we're getting from members is the degree of seriousness that organisations are taking or the degree of importance that they're placing on cybersecurity. One of the things that's been really pleasing to see is the level of attention that boards in particular are paying to cybersecurity, and the fact that it is increasingly moving up the agenda when they have their conversations about risk.
Yeah, making directors legally responsible, nothing like that to concentrate the mind.
Oh, it's a good incentive.
The law requires company directors to bear duty of care and diligence. As far as cybersecurity goes, they have to take reasonable steps to address foreseeable risks and establish and adhere to appropriate cybersecurity standards. On the government side of things, there's now a cybersecurity strategy. David Tuffley, who is at Griffith University, has had a look at it.
They've identified what our critical infrastructure is, utilities, water, electricity, phone, etc., and have instituted good protection. They're not being specific about that, but then they don't generally say what they're doing. They just do it. They don't want to tell people what they've done. They're giving businesses the tools that they need to better sort of fend off cyber attacks. There's a new way of dealing with ransomware. That's been the bane, I think, of Australian organisations for the last couple of years. And there's measures in place to do something about that. They're also looking to do something about the shortfall in skilled cybersecurity professionals.
Another thing the strategy does sounds really simple: raise awareness.
That's actually been the most important thing in many ways, because most successful cyber attacks happen because regular people working in organisations have been duped, persuaded, threatened, cajoled, any number of ways that people have been induced to click on a link, either in a phishing email or in a text message, which then loads malware onto that organisation's system, which then gives the cyber crook access. And if people stop doing that, if people knew not to do that, and I think people are becoming aware of this, but if everybody stopped doing that, then a lot of cyber problems would actually go away.
You can do a lot with technology, but ultimately the people who are targeting these companies, they're hacking human nature, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And it's a... The general method is some version of a scenario in which a sense of urgency is created. When a person is alarmed, when they're afraid, if they think something bad is about to happen, if they don't act quickly, then human nature, as you say, is geared to doing something about it. And the best cyber crooks are the ones who can seamlessly create that sense of urgency and then to offer the solution. But it's all going to be okay if you do this. Mm. And so this whole method is called the social engineering hack.
A message from hackers claiming to have stolen data from one of the country's biggest health insurers has been referred to federal police. After being hit by a cyber attack, Medibank Private has received messages from a group asking to negotiate a ransom for stolen data. Home Affairs.
How does a ransomware attack work, David?
Let's say a person has clicked on a suspect link. It has installed some malware on that protected system. Now, that malware is then able to take control of that system and essentially close down access so that nobody has access to any data. And considering that most organizations rely on their systems, this is a catastrophic event. So when people become aware that this has happened, well, panic ensues, and then comes the ransom demand.
So what then? Should people pay?
We strongly advise against doing it because, well, it sustains the ransom business model for a start, but it in no way guarantees that people will get their data back. In fact, some of the criminals will actually, out of spite, then sell that information on the dark web. So it's really not a good idea to pay the ransom, but of course it's really understandable why people would do that. So the strategy that the government has come out with is trying to break that business model. It costs Australia, I think, something up around $3 billion a year. And I believe the government has produced a ransomware playbook, which people could refer to in the event that they were attacked this way, and to help people basically respond. But I hasten to add, Richard, that if people have got backups, if they take regular backups, then the threat of ransomware really is not so great. It's the loss of the data that is really the problem. But if you've got a recent backup, well, then that's out of the reach of the cyber criminals. So this is the best thing that anyone can do.
That would reduce the risk enormously. But we also have a tool for managing risk and making it affordable: insurance. Jay Jong from the University of Melbourne.
Interestingly enough, only 20 to 25% of all businesses in Australia have cyber insurance. Small to medium enterprises have a significantly lower proportion than medium to large enterprises. And the actual cyber insurance side of the economy side is estimated to be worth around $4.2 billion in Australia alone.
Okay, $4.2 billion. But hang on, Jay, why is the take-up so low? It feels like it should be more.
The insurance companies need to know or have a fairly good idea of the amount of cyber risk a business is exposed to. And the business themselves need to understand what are the assets, what are the threats, and what are the vulnerabilities they're facing. Now, when neither party are clear on those terms, you have a bit of a problem where the business of cyber insurance doesn't add up. So insurance companies only want to cover specific companies of a specific size within a specific industry. And the other side of the business, it doesn't make any economic sense to pick up cyber insurance because of the premium cost and the coverage is so low. So for example, the Medibank issue we had a few years ago in 2022, Medibank didn't have any cyber insurance. And when asked why, they said, well, it didn't make economic sense at the point of time. The coverage wasn't going to be anything substantial to cover the cost of a cyber incident occurring anyways. So that's still a challenge. And especially if you think about small to medium medical practitioners, financial advisors and accountants, if I was an insurer, would I want to pick them up and be exposed to the risk that they have for a very minute amount of money?
The issue here is the newness of this product and of this market. Cyber insurance is a relatively new product. It's not a mature one.
Let's talk about car insurance, for example. With car insurance, when you're picking it up, you enter your age, your gender, where you park your car, how much you drive, what type of car you drive, what is its purpose, et cetera, so on and so forth. And then they are able to give you an estimated premium cost that is relative to the coverage that you require. That's only possible because there are tens of thousands of previous cases where they know roughly how much an accident or a car-related insurance claim will cost them. We don't have the same luxury cyber insurance. And the other part of it is that the risk landscape continuously changes for cyber, right? There's new modes of attack. There's new ransomware. There's new viruses that emerge in our landscape on a day-to-day basis. And coupled with geopolitical risks and other facets like AI, you have a very difficult landscape to navigate when you're talking about how much risk is out there in the cyber world.
We need more information. We need more data.
And the other thing is, remember that insurance, the whole purpose of insurance is to cover something of value, right? It's an asset. And if we talk about what the asset is in the context of cyber insurance, it's actually data. It may involve some IT equipment and your network, but most predominantly, cyber insurance is coverage of data as your asset. Then the real challenge is, how much is your data worth?
Another question a company needs to think about is, how likely are we to be targeted? Because that very much depends on the sector you're in.
The highest weekly attacks per organization by industry is actually education and research companies and organizations, which makes up for around 75% more than the average. On the other hand of the spectrum, you have hardware vendors and retail and wholesale companies where their average weekly attacks is actually significantly less than the top ones. So there is a discrepancy. The sweet spot is businesses with turnovers of excess of $50 million but are not listed on the public stock exchange. They're private companies with 50 to 250 employees turning over $50 million to $250 million, are large enough to have their own IT team, but not large enough to have their own dedicated cybersecurity team. And the reason why is that these companies have the capacity to pay off ransomware attacks. Mm. Smaller companies don't have the financial means to do so. These companies do. Ironically, the businesses with the least coverage are these businesses that we're referring to at the same time regarding cyber insurance.
So from the criminal's point of view, size matters. But it's not the only thing that matters. Abby Bradshaw is head of the Australian Signals Directorate's Cybersecurity Centre.
We've seen a lot of targeting of entities that are what we would call PII rich or personally identifiable information rich. So companies which have and hold sensitive data and lots of it have increasingly become targets of cyber criminals. And the benefit, of course, of targeting entities which hold vast amounts of sensitive data is you don't even have to have the technical competence to encrypt networks before you start extorting a company. You only need to have obtained access and to exfiltrate some data in order to engage in that extortion. And that's what we've seen over the last couple of years.
There's no shortage of that kind of target.
I've had students of mine complain about the amount of documentation a real estate agent requires you to provide when you're applying for a rental application. They want to know your name, you need your passport, you need your bank account, you need, you know, some sort of referral letter, you need all sorts of documentation that the real estate agent needs to provide your rental property. Now, where is all of those documentation and data stored? Does real estate agents have the necessary control mechanisms to deal with the cyber breach attack? I can't actually tell you what type of cybersecurity measures these smaller franchisees have and how safe your data is.
I'm Richard Aidy. This time on The Money, we're looking at cyber attacks. There's one every 6 minutes in Australia, and last year the cost was estimated at $42 billion. It's real money. So how are the criminal gangs getting into our systems? Well, some of them use what are called access brokers, who sell their entry points into companies on the dark web.
The most common way for them to obtain that access is to monitor pieces of software or often what we would call edge devices or devices which would enable a virtual private network. They wait until a vulnerability is disclosed, so a public vulnerability would be disclosed by that software company or vendor company, and they would, in that disclosure, provide a patch that would fix the bug in the software or the device. But what the criminals do is they know that entities won't always patch as soon as it becomes available, and they will go out immediately within hours of the publication of that vulnerability and attempt to prosecute networks which have not yet been patched. And then they will maintain that access and sell it off.
Moral of the story, keep up to date on your updates and patches. What else, Abby?
Number one is to join the ASD Cybersecurity Partnership Program. And you can do that simply by going to cyber.gov.au. This is a partnership program which we have grown from just a few thousand 5 years ago to 110,000 partners across Australia. And that includes thousands of business partners, so small to medium enterprise owners, thousands of network owners, so we provide cybersecurity advice and assistance to businesses who operate their own networks. And when we're aware of a piece of information or intelligence that might impact you as an entity or your sector, we will reach out to you.
The second thing Abby Bradshaw recommends is to adopt the advice at cyber.gov.au. Whether your company's small or enormous, there's guides aimed at each level, and all of them will help a firm improve its cybersecurity.
The third thing is to stay engaged with the Cybersecurity Centre. The Cybersecurity Centre is actually part of the Australian Signals Directorate, which is a Foreign Intelligence Agency, and all of our public-facing advice and assistance is informed by the best top-secret intelligence about methods that are being utilised by state-based actors and criminal actors to compromise our networks. So we're not a regulator. So when you call us, you know that our primary effort is on engaging with the victim entity and supporting that entity through what could be one of the worst days of their lives.
A day like this one in March last year.
Latitude Financial has revealed that the cyber hack on its systems is far worse than originally thought. The provider of credit cards and short-term loans now says 8 million of its customers, both here and in New Zealand, have had their personal details stolen.
All right, David Cullen at CyberLens, what do you tell your members if they find themselves in this situation?
We'd encourage every organisation that is concerned about a cybersecurity incident to contact the Australian Signals Directorate's Australian Cybersecurity Centre. We know that those first few hours are critical in any incident, and we need cyber teams across the country to be able to speak freely to the Australian Signals Directorate about their experiences without having those discussions caught up in red tape or the bureaucracy that surrounds a regulatory notification. We certainly know there's always a time and place for that, and that's important work that needs to happen. We just feel that it's not at the time that we first identify a potential problem.
And that gets us to an issue.
So increasingly what we've seen over the last couple of years in particular is a reticence of entities to engage with us, or entities will ask their lawyers to talk to our technical folk rather than their technical folk. And we think that this stems from a concern that the information passed to us will be used for regulatory or penalty purposes. And that's what industry have told us in various industry consultation engagements that we've had. And so we've looked at our counterparts, including, for example, in the United States, where they have legislation in place which is designed to elevate options for collaboration by actually providing what they call limited use around the transaction of that information. And what that means is if information is shared by a victim of a cybercrime with the Australian Signals Directorate Cybersecurity Centre, that information can only be used for a purpose associated with our cybersecurity functions.
What we're really looking for here, and what the government has put forward as part of its new strategy, is to legislate and formalise a limited use obligation for the Australian Signals Directorate, which would give the Australian Cybersecurity Centre and its team of incredible experts the opportunity to work very openly and very quickly with companies who identify that something might be going wrong, and ideally get ahead of it without the fear, importantly, of that information, that knowledge that's been exchanged, being shared with regulators who might want to initiate regulatory action or an investigation based on what it is that they've just learned.
When an organisation's hacked and the data's stolen, it affects that organisation's ability to function. It affects its customers and clients, and it affects its reputation. But
it would be a mistake for organisations to plan on the basis that the worst cyber day they could have is one in which their data is stolen. That is a dreadful thing to happen to a company and to the people impacted. But we have seen internationally the enormous impacts that can come when services are actually disrupted.
Well, for most of the last week, a fuel pipeline running between Texas and New York was shut down by hackers. It normally carries almost half of the East Coast's fuel needs. The closure caused widespread shortages and panic buying at petrol stations.
Yeah, you know, it's been crazy.
The ripple effects of that were profound all the way through to petrol shortages at Bowser's across the country and shortages of airline fuel causing disruptions and delays across the air transport network as well. So, yes, the loss of data is significant and will always be important to us. But one of the things that's important to acknowledge is that when these things go wrong, and when they go wrong in a really bad way, we will also need to be mindful of any of those ripple effects or first, second and third order consequences that can come from them.
So we need entities to get people practicing what their response would be, what their business continuity plans are, how they would run payroll, how they would run their communications if their email's not available, how they would continue to operate if services are disrupted.
The Optus hack, followed quickly by the Medicare hack, changed the game in terms of awareness. The Latitude Financial hack a few months later really underlined that. Cybersecurity is taken much more seriously at a much higher level than it used to be. But what could be improved? Abby Bradshaw from the ASD's Cybersecurity Centre.
I think there are two things. We need to see that awareness now transitioning into action. We need to see an improved, I think, dialogue between C-suite and cybersecurity advisors or CISOs in organisations, where we actually need an uplift in communication skills, in my view, on both sides, both from the CISOs to communicate in a way that is consumable by the C-suite, but also for those that sit on boards to increase their own understanding.
David Tuffley, you're at Griffith University. From your observations, is the private sector now doing enough to protect itself?
Certainly, they are taking it a lot more seriously. There is the catastrophic loss of reputation, the incalculable damage that is done by a major breach. You know, Optus will be a long time living that down. So I think they are rapidly starting to take it seriously. And what that really comes down to is that there are strong voices on boards of directors arguing for proper funding. In the past, I think a lot of boards of directors didn't have technical people there. I think, you know, there was finance, there was sales, there were, you know, a variety of skills. But now I think there's a very strong case for having technology savvy people on boards of directors who can foresee where these threats are coming from and then take proactive action to prevent it. So really, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
And on that, there's straightforward, practical measures that every organisation can take. Jay Jong from the University of Melbourne.
For example, there are basic cybersecurity policies and processes that you incorporate into your business, or implementation of basic, you know, security control mechanisms like multi-factor authentication, or even just basic education, training, and awareness programs like phishing simulation attacks. Those are all really cost, affordable, easy, well, relatively easy and relatively instantaneous methods of reducing the cyber risk before you engage with the consultant or look to pick up cyber insurance.
Thanks to Jay Jong, who's a senior research fellow in the School of Computing and Information Systems at the University of Melbourne. Also David Tuffley, senior lecturer in cybersecurity at Griffith University. Abby Bradshaw, head of the Australian Signals Directorate's Cybersecurity Centre. David Cullen, national director of advocacy at CISO Lens. And we also heard from Nick Espinoza from Security Fanatics. The money comes to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Next time on the show, we'll look at something that more and more of us face, and it extracts quite the cost: loneliness. The money is produced by Whitney Fitzsimmons. Our sound engineer is Harvey O'Sullivan. I'm Richard Adie.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.